Very pleased and proud to be joined right now by Dr. Mehmet Oz. You know him as Dr. Oz. You can see him on Channel 32 afternoons. And we talked last week about where we were then. Where we are now is significantly different. New York really has been overrun by this. I know you practice in New York. What are you seeing?
Well, on the front lines, it's looking a little better today, certainly much better than last week. We're stabilizing in that we don't have more cases this week than last week. That still means we're overrun, and because the people from last week are still alive, we're just cramming more people into the space. But the good news is that, in theory, and this should happen, next week we'll have a little less cases, so we'll start to ski downhill rather than uphill. And as the current patients get discharged, it'll open up enough space to be able to manage the folks that are coming in. And although deaths were very high yesterday, the number of patients admitted to the ICU and number of people putting breathing tubes into are going down. Those are all very big positives.
What do you assign that to?
Social distancing, the lockdown, there's no question, especially in a place as densely populated as New York City. Asking people to voluntarily not be near each other is impossible. It's just too crowded. Subways were a catastrophe for us. So expecting people to get to work in a confined environment where we know it's not someone sneezing in your face that makes you sick. It's someone literally just talking and making words like health, right? The of health aerosolizes little droplets of water that have virus in them. They travel, 6 feet maybe, create a little cloud. You walk through that cloud. If you're in an elevator, which is even a bigger problem than a subway, which in New York City is essential because the buildings are so tall, and that's true for most major U.S. cities, Chicago included, you're gonna be in a cesspool of virus, basically, because someone sneezed 10 minutes ago, we'll still have material circulating around because it can stay up in the air half an hour.
That's pretty daunting. You say the cases are evening out. Is that in the number of cases or the severity of cases or both?
Well, they're directly related to each other. And as we get better at taking care of people, you get more and more severe cases living longer and longer. The average person who gets a breathing tube in will spend 2 weeks on that tube and 50% mortality rate. So, you don't always succeed, but you succeed a lot more than you used to. And that means you've got to keep trying your hardest on everybody. And those people tie up ventilators that the next generation of patients, the next graduates want. But as the number of people getting sick goes down proportionally, number of older people with comorbidities goes down, they're the ones who get intubated and end up in the end often dying.
Do you think that there's a relationship between how sick people are getting, especially younger people are getting, based on the viral load that they first encounter?
Anecdotally, yes. I can't prove that. It does seem like there are a disproportionate number of healthcare workers, young ones who get sick, and I think that might be because they get a huge virus load when someone sneezes in their face or they're trying to put a breathing tube in and they cough in their face and that all goes right down their lungs. And so that might play a role. The virus itself has a weird course. In most people, it does nothing, right? It literally nothing, or so trivial that, you wouldn't make a big deal about it. In the people who do have symptoms, oftentimes they'll deal with the virus and then they'll get this sort of rebound where a big inflammatory reaction takes place. And more we think that the bad lung disease that we're seeing is more a result of the civil war waged inside their bodies as opposed to the virus directly causing harm.
Is that why one of the treatments that they're talking about is actually reducing your immune reaction?
It is a major opportunity to curtail a devastating nuclear war that the body wages against the virus, because the virus is often dead, or it doesn't need that much of an attack to beat it back. And yet the side effects, the collateral damage of that nuclear war is the glassy-looking lungs, the inability to oxygenate, which is an important point, by the way. It's not just that the lungs don't look good. You can't move oxygen in the body, so you basically are suffocating. For many, liken it to high-altitude sickness. And it's very hard to treat that. And so if you can turn off some of the interleukins that are the messengers that create that overreaction of the body, you have the ability to sort of calm the body down. We think that's why women may live more than men, because although they both get infected, women have twice as many men than women die in most countries. So we think, initially I thought that was because they smoked and they ate the wrong things and they were overweight, but it's not just lifestyle stuff. There's a genetic difference, and it might be the estrogen, because it's disproportionately affecting young men in that setting, or it just might be the extra X chromosome that women have, give them a bunch of extra immune messaging that allows them to perfectly tune their response so they don't overreact as much as men do.
That's fascinating. Are there any treatments that you are very optimistic about, Dr. Oz?
I mean, there's nothing proven. There are some that I think might be effective early on. Hydroxychloroquine is a malaria drug that's been used with some success. in case studies in France, and there was one randomized trial in China, but there was another randomized trial that showed it didn't work. So I think it's partly picking the right patient group. At least that's a drug that's fairly safe. So for most doctors, it's a drug they'll think about. Again, it's a prescription drug, so doctors have to prescribe it. I do think the antivirals could play a role by slowing down virus replication in people who are more sick. I wouldn't give it to people who are doing okay. In fact, I wouldn't give anything to people who are doing okay except something for the fever and pain, you know, discomfort management. And I think one day we might want to find out that some of these medications you asked me about that turn off interleukins and tumor necrosis factor could play a role, or even the ability to take antibodies from people who survived from their blood and give it to people who are dying to sort of jumpstart their system. All these are hypotheses that could work.
I want to go back to hydroxychloroquine for a moment, because one of the ways that that drug acts, I'm told, is that it does knock down your antibody response slightly. Is the timing of administering a drug like that very important? Because you don't want to give it too early, because you do want your body to react initially to the infection, don't you?
It's very difficult to tell when they give it, because we can't even tell if it works. But if we're going to give it, it seems from the French data and from the Chinese randomized trial that you probably want to give it relatively early in the course so you can modify whatever's going on. Again, most of the time the body deals with this virus just fine, so why it can't in some cases is more mysterious. It does not seem like immunosuppressed patients have a bigger problem with this virus. Right now I'm doing a program with our partners at ShareCare, combing through millions of insurance claims, trying to find out if patients with lupus who normally take hydroxychloroquine, this malaria drug that's given for lupus too for the reason you stated, is it possible that those patients are not getting COVID-19 as frequently as you would think? And they're certainly not anecdotally getting it more than you think, because the biggest practice in the country is at Cedars-Sinai, and the head guy there, Dr. Daniel Wallace, told me he hasn't had a single patient in his practice of 800 patients who had COVID-19. So the rheumatology community is impressed at how few of their patients seem to be getting this virus. Now, we'll see what happens over time, or maybe they're getting the virus, but their reaction is not bad, so they don't realize it. But for whatever reason, if they're already on the medication, it doesn't seem to make them worse. So if I was going to give it, I'd wait for someone who had symptoms, and if they had risk factors, let's say they're older or they have comorbidities, because that's where most of the deaths happen, and those are the people that early on I'd probably give it to, probably azithromycin, checking an EKG just to make sure that don't cause some problem, although that's not been a common issue, and maybe add zinc, and I'd see how that ran for a couple days. But again, this is purely based on talking to a lot of people who have experience, but no one's done the trials to prove these.
And what is the reason for the antibiotic?
You know, there's two reasons. One, it does seem like bacteria do sometimes super infect the damaged lung, but there seems to be a direct antiviral effect of azithromycin. This has been talked about for a while. I used to always scoff at it, thinking, hey, why are you giving a sore throat azithromycin? Because it's Z-Pak, right, the basic drug that's commonly prescribed anyway. But, you know, certainly my wife would always argue that it works, and others have felt the same, and it does have a direct antiviral effect. I don't think that's the main reason it's working here, but that was one of the hypotheses offered by the French researcher Didier Raoult, who's a world-famous infectious disease specialist. And sometimes this is more, it's more like making a bouillabaisse than taking care of patients with very specific meds. You don't know exactly because you're in the middle of the battle. You just sort of figure out what makes common sense to you, even though it's not common to everybody else, and give it a shot. And he's had reasonable results, although, again, not randomized.
Dr. Oz, how much longer do you think we're going to be dealing with this disease? Weeks, months, or years?
Some parts of the country can do better than other parts. New York City, where I am, is not going anywhere in the next month. But I do think much of the country, the way the virus has not hit that hard, can start to get back on its feet. It's going to be critical that we develop techniques, wise approaches to dealing with the outbreaks that are bound to happen afterwards. So as I've been telling my audience, and I'll share it with yours, we need case finding, contact tracing, and quarantining. That's the key. Case finding, identify people early when they get infected, so you have to have testing. Contact tracing, so anybody they've been close to in the last couple of days, let's say within 6 feet for more than 10 minutes, define that as contact, that they all have to be notified that they're now at high risk and they all have to get quarantined. And I know you say, oh, it's not fair. Well, what's not fair is you were closer than 6 feet for 10 minutes. Just don't do that and you won't be quarantined. But if you're going to take the risk of being close to someone, have an intimate lunch with somebody for more than 10 minutes, closer than 6 feet, and they get sick a couple days later, you're getting quarantined. Because we can't take the chance that you'll either be asymptomatic when you get ill or your symptoms are going to come up 7 days later, but you'll be spewing virus for the, you know, for 3 days without realizing you have symptoms.
And how important is this blood serum technology so that we'll be able to track people who've had it and now we believe have some sort of antibody to it?
Vital. Without, if you don't have testing, then you don't have a containment program. It just can't be done. And that's what hurt us. The single biggest error in America in this virus was the lack of testing. Complete, utter problem, because none of the leaders, none of the guys who knew this stuff could do anything because they didn't know what they were looking at. And so you can't fly blind. We have to have testing, both the testing in the nose, which is PCR testing, where you actually get the virus to express whether it's there or not, and then you have to have the antibody testing to show whether you already had it, whether you realized it or not, and are now immune. Both are valuable. The first is important because you're contagious, and we don't want you infecting people. The second is important because you'll know you're safe and can go to work, and maybe you can do things no one else can do, but it also gives us an idea of the epidemiology of the virus. How widespread is it? If 50% of the population has had it, we're much less worried than if 10% has had it.
All right. Dr. Mehmet Oz. Dr. Oz, you can see him afternoons on Channel 32, Fox 32 in Chicago. Thank you, doctor. Appreciate it.
God bless you. Good luck. Bye-bye.